love coffee? What if I told you that there was one simple thing that you could change that would elevate your coffee from good to the best you've ever had? That simple change is switching to freshly roasted coffee. But how do you do that when coffee distributors aren't required to tell you when their coffee was roasted? Some coffee you find at the grocery store or your local cafe could have been sitting on the shelf for months before it got to you. Which is why it's time to switch to Sparkplug coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans. Their coffee is sourced directly and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half-caf. But the best part is that they deliver this coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug offers autopilot, set-it-and-forget-it delivery, and now, for Top 100 Project listeners, Sparkplug is offering 10% off any size coffee order if you enter the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, the number 100. The offer does not apply to any of the coffee gear that Sparkplug sells, but it applies to any size coffee order, even if you're already a customer. So what are you waiting for? The time has never been better to treat yourself to the best cup of coffee you've ever had, made in your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey there, humans, and we send thank yous your way for investing some of your time in hearing the Next 100 Project, the weekly podcast that features two people jawing about movie classics. That jawing usually includes a large amount of spoilers, and it probably will today, too. I'm your militant host, Ryan Ellis X, and here she is, my longtime companion and my supportive wife, Bev Shabazz.
That's me.
Okay, the coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Malcolm X. Spike Lee has directed two movies that have grossed more than $100 million when you adjust for inflation. One of them is Malcolm X. What is the other one?
I knew it was going to be something I completely forgot about because he's made so many films that are easy to forget that he made, but it was Inside Man from just over 10 years ago.
And after that, his biggest hits are Jungle Fever, Original Kings of Comedy, and Do the Right Thing, all in the $60 million range adjusted, but nothing else is even close to $100 million. So he's been a guy who's made movies that haven't failed, flat out, very often. We talked about that on Do the Right Thing. That movie did succeed. This movie did succeed. But he isn't really a hitmaker, per se, unless he makes Inside Man or Malcolm X, as it turns out.
But he has had a couple of epic bombs. Old Boy made, what, 6 million internationally?
Okay, yeah, that's one.
But even something like She Hate Me didn't even gross 1 million. Bamboozled was another one, although Bamboozled was made very cheap, but still.
Most of his movies have been made cheap, and he doesn't get a huge budget, so that's one reason why it's not so scandalous compared to, say, The Lone Ranger, which is thought of as a huge bust, or Waterworld back in its day, because they weren't costing the studio so much money to begin with.
Yeah, it's all relative.
Budget on this picture is an absolutely important story, which we'll get to very soon. The Next 100 Project's 83rd motion picture, Malcolm X, was not nominated for the 1998 or 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Warner Brothers released the film just 5 days shy of 25 years ago on November 18th, 1992. Bev, remind people what it's about with your Malcolm X skinny.
Denzel Washington is Malcolm X, infamous, controversial, and influential civil rights activist and member of the Nation of Islam. He goes from a child of the foster system to a New York gangster to a prisoner and devout convert to Islam to a fiery lightning rod of a speaker and a leader who's ultimately betrayed by his own people.
Or, in a nutshell, the evangelist makes a lot of wrong decisions, then gets assassinated once he starts making the right ones. Isn't that ironic? He starts becoming a person of all the people, and that's when he gets killed because he dares to speak against his church. So the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 91% of the critics liked the movie, 50 fresh and 5 rotten, and 91% of audiences liked the movie. It was Roger Ebert's number one in 1992 after JFK. It was his favorite movie the year before, so he liked the incendiary movies that pissed a lot of people off in those 2 years. X was 32nd at the 1992 U.S. box office. Aladdin was number one. A League of Their Own, which we covered this year, right? Yeah, it was 10th. And Unforgiven, which was on the Top 100 Project, was 11th. Well, this movie is about a punk who becomes a prophet and is your second viewing, but not for a long time, I believe, right? I haven't seen it in a while myself. What'd you think of Malcolm X?
It has two big strikes against it for me right off the bat because it's two things I typically hate. It's a biopic, which is my least favorite genre film, and it's over 3 hours long. Nevertheless, I really like it. Maybe the length doesn't drag it down because it's pretty episodic. It feels more like binge-watching a miniseries with each part of his life kind of being an act of this larger story. And the story itself is just really impactful. This is only the second time I've seen Malcolm X, and I saw it when it first came out back in 1992. But I still clearly remember a great deal of it from my first viewing 25 years ago, surprising amount. But the biggest impression it makes is this successful impression of a fully fleshed out human being. He's complex, honest, and heartbreaking.
And he evolves. I don't know if that's actually true. It's probably close. You can view a lot of archival footage to see what he actually said. And I think that's one of the most impressive things about the whole story of Malcolm X is that he's a guy, like I said, made all the wrong decisions to being a guy who got to be an important figure. And if he'd just been that blacks and whites shouldn't merge thing, I wouldn't have approved of that, but at least he was doing something useful with his life and trying to help his people. But then he became a better person and said, why am I excluding whites? Or why am I excluding Asians? Why am I excluding anyone? And it seemed like he was creating a rainbow coalition. Of course, Jesse Jackson tried to do that later on. And he was murdered for daring to go against his own church. At least he believes that. When they firebomb his house, he says right away, it's the Nation of Islam. He's not saying it's white people. He's not saying it's the FBI or the CIA. In the movie, at least, he's accusing black people of doing this to him.
And the great tragedy in the film as it's presented, or in his life, I should say, is not that he was murdered. It's not that violence was committed. He says, I always expected to die. What I didn't expect was betrayal. That is the great tragedy in his life, that these people who he trusted turn against him. And throughout the course of the film, you see that he is really easy to influence. He's easy to influence by Archie, his gangster boss, who becomes this father figure to him, betrays him. He's easy to influence once he's in prison. He meets, I can't remember his name, the character in prison.
Baines. It's Albert Hall from Apocalypse Now.
Right.
The captain of the boat.
Yes.
Who's so preachy in the whole movie, but it's a pretty good performance.
And ultimately turns on him. And then it's Elijah Muhammad, who is really the brains behind the assassination. And it's heartbreaking to see that the moment that he finally starts thinking for himself and he steps out from under the shadow of all these father figures that he worships, and he has this incredible charisma, this talent, this leadership quality that he only uses to help other people, and then he finally turns it on like his own thoughts and his own goals towards making humanity better, that's when they betray him.
Kind of Jesus-esque.
He is betrayed by his own people. It makes you curious about just what the world lost when they lost Malcolm X, because he was an incredibly controversial figure because he was against whites. I don't think whites and blacks
should mix. They're the devil and we shouldn't mix races. He was saying that, at least in this movie, he was saying that on podiums very clearly.
Spike Lee has many times kind of been the one who expresses that voice of black American anger. It's an expression that I think a lot of people are afraid of because they see it as an enemy to progress. Love is much easier to market than hate. But that means that there's a massive common experience that's never illustrated or expressed in American culture. Black people have every right to be furious, and it's kind of tyrannical that this expression is denied them and they receive so much criticism for what is a completely valid response. I think this is mirrored in feminist activism. We're highly discouraged from ever making blanket statements about men. We're supposed to work patiently with the system to incrementally improve our lives despite resistance. Even worse than resistance, atrophy and ambivalence, which I think is the real enemy. So when occasionally a woman like Rose McGowan or Maxine Waters has just had enough and lets us all know, that is pure catharsis. So I can only imagine how refreshing a figure Malcolm X must have been to black Americans who were just like, yeah, 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 love, that's all well and good. But actually that message kind of allows people to do nothing because it pretends that all you have to do is think happy thoughts and everything will get better, when, as a matter of fact, things weren't getting better for them, and these messages of love were completely antithetical to what they were living in their everyday lives. And it's refreshing to see Spike Lee express that sentiment. I get why people are afraid of it, and I get why it upsets white people. It upsets the powerful. But protecting the feelings of their ruling class is exhausting and honestly counterproductive. It's a shame that there aren't more pieces of work like this that expresses. And Washington's performance could be defined by this seething rage that lies beneath every interaction he has. You know, sometimes very explicit, like he has the fantasy of smashing the pie into the face of that train passenger, or the way he treats his white girlfriend Sophia is full of this seething resentment. But usually it's just a tension in his voice and the room and the way he behaves. It's like a micro expression, but it defines his entire performance.
Denzel's intensity and focus in this film is at the max. He's glaring holes through people. Not always angrily, but the actor is so focused in this role. It's probably his very best. It's certainly way up there. It's funny, too, that his character is, of course, Malcolm Little. That's his real name. He's called Red early on. Then, of course, he becomes Malcolm X at the, not the end, but through maybe half the movie. He has one hell of an arc. It's one of the best arcs any character's ever had in a movie. I read somewhere it's the most screen time a best actor performance has ever had, although I thought that Charlton Heston and Ben-Hur had as much or more. The movie's even longer in Ben-Hur's case.
And what about Peter O'Toole in Lawrence of Arabia, no?
It's up there, let's put it that way. It's certainly on the short list of being on screen all the time. And the guy's been in so many movies. We all know Denzel Washington, the Oscars for Glory, Training Day, so many movies with Spike Lee. Richard Pryor and Eddie Murphy were once attached to the project, I guess, as Malcolm X. I think in Pryor's case, it would have been as Malcolm X. Murphy might have been a supporting player. But they would have been the wrong casting. I was reading that people criticized Denzel's casting because he's too short. Well, Jesus Christ, when you're doing a movie about a real person, you can't always get exactly the right person. I really hate when people get hung up about that. The child of the actors doesn't look exactly the same as them because it's not their fucking kid.
Yeah.
Or the actor or the actress isn't exactly the same height or the exactly the same eye color. Who cares? He looks a lot like him, and the bottom line is the performance is incredible. The movie starts with the opening credits and Malcolm's incendiary speech while a flag burns and Rodney King is beaten. That had happened the year before, and then the verdict with the cops who beat on him was just a few months before the movie came out, so it was very fresh in everyone's mind, and the riots had started by that point, I believe, in L.A., so this movie was timely in that way. I don't think Spike picked that on purpose. He wanted to make a movie about Malcolm X. It happened to come out at this point. It's not a one-man show, and it's not all about the Nation of Islam, either. In the beginning of the film, Spike gets to do a musical, complete with the Zoot Suits. Most directors want to do a musical. Spielberg got to do a mini-musical at the beginning of Temple of Doom. Scorsese did one way back when with New York, New York. And then, of course, some of the stuff early on where Malcolm's trying to be white. The things we do for vanity, the hair straightening, trying to look like he's not a black guy. But what about that racism against himself? What did you think of that?
Racism? Oh, that he straightens his hair.
Trying to look white.
The first time we meet the character, he is getting his hair straightened. It's a great metaphor because it's a painful process that they have to go through to artificially change their hair to more closely resemble white people.
And he acts tough. Oh, it's fine. It's fine. No, it's not fine. Not fine. When it must hurt so bad for him to even admit it's as bad as it is.
When I talk about the impression that this movie made on me when I was a kid and I first saw it 25 years ago, that was one of the things that really stuck with me. Just as a scene and an experience, and they do it again in the prison, but also as a metaphor, and that people point out, you're just trying to look white. Later on, he's a member of the Nation of Islam. He is clearly very pro-black and anti-white, but Betty still straightens her hair. A lot of the women still relax their hair.
They don't show her doing that process, though.
No, they don't show it. They just see that she has relaxed hair. No black woman naturally has hair like her hair, which she covers anyway, and yet you still see when it's uncovered, it's straightened.
Didn't pick up on that.
Well, it's a big issue with black women and hair, natural hair, and how they wear it. As much as this may have been a thing in the 40s, that black men straightened their hair, and they don't really tend to very much anymore, there's actually a lot of pressure on black women to straighten their hair and to get their hair right. There was a whole documentary made about it with Chris Rock.
Chris Rock made it, yeah.
Good Hair, I think it's called. Mm-hmm. It's not bad. It's insightful for white people to watch and kind of get a glimpse into this world that you would never think about, but it is an insidious thing that fashion still dictates that black people should try to look more like white people. But I think it was just internalized racism, the way everybody internalizes racism, sexism, and he was young, and of course he was a victim of this. I'm glad that you brought up the dance sequence at the beginning. I love that. I think there's something interesting about the sequence, which could seem easily like it's superfluous, but it's a very old Hollywood style dance sequence that Lee constructs these elaborate, choreographed, ambitious scenes in the style of old Hollywood at the beginning. All those beautiful styles that Hollywood indulged in were always historically completely absent of black people. There's a real power in seeing yourself represented in all that glamour, the outfits, the music, and the sweeping camera moves. It's refreshing for me to see it. And I'm a white person in 2017. Again, can you imagine what kind of an impact image like that would have if you were a black American in 1992? I actually love how much the movie shows what a vain person Malcolm X was. Maybe vain isn't the correct word, but how much he cared about aesthetics and his image. The beginning of the film is very, very focused on that. And I think any charismatic figure like that couldn't be that way and couldn't be successful without very consciously cultivating an image that changed really dramatically when he makes that big 180 when he goes into prison and he converts to Islam, and he's this gregarious, happy, friendly, smiling person, this real character in the beginning of the film, and then he turns into this quiet, serious, but whip-smart leader, very sober man in the second half of the film, and you have to think this is a persona that he built and that he's expressing, and the film isn't really shy about showing that there was a mechanism behind it and that there was an intent behind it.
One of his lessons to white students is told very calmly, but then his sermons to the blacks are loud and they're pissed off. And I guess you could say he's performing in both cases. He's tamping himself down for the whites and he's amping himself up for the blacks. And maybe Malcolm X in reality was somewhere in the middle, like most people probably are. He's like a wrestler. He's got to turn the volume up to 11. Be the same guy, but amp the volume up when they go in front of the camera. There's a lot of N-words thrown around in the movie, and also a lot of honorable Elijah Muhammads thrown around. That might be said more than the N-word, actually, because that character is mentioned over and over again, and Malcolm worships this guy, so he is so disillusioned, maybe more than anyone ever would be when he finds out the guy is a hypocrite by banging women and having kids out of wedlock with them, and not even taking care of them, which is even worse. If he'd found out that he did those things and that the kids were being taken care of, he might have felt a little differently. But that's his turning point in the whole movie.
Yeah, there was a choice to portray Malcolm as a pawn rather than an influential figure in his own right. It could be a choice by Lee to absolve Malcolm X of all of the really divisive aspects of the Nation of Islam, like their vilification of all whites and also black people who work with white people. You know, they would call them Uncle Toms. They made enemies of a lot of black activists. And the film completely ignores that the group has like a long vocal history of anti-Semitism.
No, that's not really addressing this. It's a Hollywood movie, so that's maybe one of the reasons why they had a hard time getting it made and then getting funding in post-production, which is something we'll get to in a little bit here. That leads me to one point I gotta say that I'm sure any of our black listeners are gonna object to me saying, but I've always disagreed with the notion that blacks born here, I guess America specifically, but Canada as well, are African. You're not. You're Canadian or you're American. Your heritage may be from there, but all of our heritages are from Africa. Every single person. Hey, good news, racists, or bad news, I guess. All of us are from there.
How do you feel when people call white people European Americans?
Bullshit. We just came from the Portuguese part of Toronto. You're Canadian. Okay, maybe actually some of them weren't. They probably were born over there and came over here. So, okay, they're Portuguese who live here. I don't know for sure, but that's probably true because our neighbors were quite old. But their daughters and sons and grandsons and all that kind of thing, granddaughters, whatever, if they're going to say that they're Portuguese first, they're not. They're Canadian if they were fucking born here. You can appreciate your heritage, and that's great. And black people especially should certainly appreciate their heritage of being way back when from Africa, but they're specifically not from Africa.
Most of the cultures that express what you might consider an excessive attachment to their culture are cultures that are usually systematically oppressed. Particularly black people are told in the media and even in history books and school, the way they're treated, they must see it everywhere in subtle ways and in much more overt ways. Calling yourself African-American and relating to your culture first before your citizenship is a reaction against being told all your life that your culture is inferior or your race is inferior, even though race is a concept that, you know, we're not qualified to really get too deep into that conversation. And that was true for Portuguese Canadians and for immigrants from Ireland and Portugal and Italy. And still, there's lots of groups that come here that are vilified now the way that they were more so in the 50s. So I think that that's where that attachment comes from and where they have to find pride in their own culture. And sometimes they want to shout it from the mountaintop because you have to shout to drown out the voices that are trying to tell you the opposite. And if a group tells me what they want to be called, my instinct is, what does it hurt me? If you want to be referred to as one way or another, it's just a respectful thing to do to admit that, A, I can't understand what they go through. I can't understand what it's like to be black in America or black in Canada. So if there's anything that I can do that they're overtly asking me to do, whether it's through language or any number of things that can make their lives better and help diminish the oppression that they suffer, then okay.
That's fair. I think it's also inaccurate to call them black, which we've all done for so long. very few people who look anything like that are remotely close to being black. They're actually brown, although we call Indians and Pakistanis brown. They're not really that color either. They're light brown, I guess.
So let's talk about the definition of black. This great scene, which was another thing that I remembered from when I saw the movie when I was 15 years old, was that scene where they open the dictionary and they look at the definition of black. That actually is like kind of a strange way to describe them, but the dominant culture calls them black in a way to additionally vilify them and additionally associate them with what they consider to be inferior.
Dark and negative and bad. Those are some of the things in the dictionary that he reads when Bane shows him the actual dictionary. And of course, white's all about being pure and honest and upfront, upstanding, all that kind of stuff.
And this conversation we're having right now, I think, is very much evidence that words matter, semantics matter.
Most of us aren't white, by the way. Some people really are white. But very few people that we know are actually white. We're whatever the hell that color is. Pink isn't what it is either, but we lean more pink than we do white.
And even calling our skin tone flesh tone or skin tone. When people say flesh tone, they associate it with Caucasian skin tone. That in itself is a damaging notion that our skin tone is the default skin tone. There's a lot to unpack here. There's a lot going on. These are 2017 versions of civil rights rather than the 1950s and 60s version of civil rights, which I think were more desperate. Their lives were even that much harder to live back then. And it's nice now that we can get into these arguments about semantics, because hopefully it means that we're overcoming the more life-threatening aspects of oppression.
A movie made 25 years ago about an era that was about 30 years before that. And really, the whole history of that is hundreds of years before that.
That's history, man. If you don't do enough to correct course, then the history of that great American crime really does seep into the lives of generation after generation until people stand up and fight it. I have mixed feelings about people like Malcolm X, and every oppressed group has a similar figure who is very divisive and just angry and just expressing the most extreme opposite point of view to the dominant culture, which is to say, no, you know what, forget it. I'm not going to try and make nice with you. I'm not going to try to work within the system. I'm angry and I'm going to fight you. And I think you kind of need that extreme to help sway culture in that direction and maybe help influence the more center progressive forces that will probably appear to have more influence on culture, but need to be pushed further and further by these extreme voices. Although Nation of Islam, man, that's a tough one. They have some pretty controversial views. And he was a pretty controversial figure, man. A lot of people did not like Malcolm X for some reasons that are kind of fair.
When he goes to prison, and especially when he's in solitary confinement, that breaks him. But it also remakes him, because he meets Baines there and he discovers the Nation of Islam. And he comes out this calm person who does nothing like what he did before he went into jail. He forgoes alcohol. There's that scene with the FBI agents who are listening to him talk to his wife and says he's a saint compared to Martin Luther King, who of course was messing around and fucking women by the threes, just like JFK was. People always talk about how JFK was killed, then it was MLK, and then it was RFK. And Malcolm X is the one who's excluded from that. And he wasn't as important as two politicians. One, he was actually president, and a guy who, well, maybe MLK wouldn't have ever been president, but he was way up there in the social strata of America. Malcolm X wasn't quite at that point. He probably would have been, but I think he's one of the more important ones to include. And I've said many times, I think one of the reasons why politicians really don't take a stand, they're certainly paid for a lot of the time by corporate interests. That's true. But they're also probably worried about getting gunned down like those four guys did in the span of about 5 years.
Yeah, I wonder if that made an impression on a whole generation, really thinking twice before you challenge the system.
And really try to change things, because JFK was trying to remake the CIA. If you want to believe Oliver Stone's point of view, they're the ones that whacked him, because he was trying to take them down, and they wanted to go back to the way things were done before.
Perhaps another reason why Malcolm X doesn't make that list is because he was assassinated by his own group.
And he wasn't as important as the K's were either. He was getting there, I think, though. That's the thing. It's one of those movies where you watch and see, this guy was going to be awesome. He was getting it. He was fucking getting it.
Yeah.
And then his own people just decided to blow him away.
I really think that's what Lee had in mind. Oh, he just turned a corner. And the potential that he would have had to influence people, to take the following that he already had and to turn it in that direction, he really could have done some good. But just like Martin Luther King, you know, got taken out. And they're not even the only two. There were lots of
Medgar Evers, another one.
That's it. I couldn't remember his name, but thank you.
We talked about his power and influence. The police station scene with all the military-like discipline. I always remember that scene so much, including the Peter Boyle line. He has a cameo. That's too much power for one man to have. Well, he should be saying that's too much power for one black man to have. It's what he's really thinking.
Yeah. That must have freaked them right out. It's impactful, though.
There's so many arbitrary rules in the Nation of Islam, at least portrayed in the movie. Again, we have to go by what we're watching in this movie. You have to be a certain height and a certain age. I think that was more about marrying than anything else, wasn't it? It was all about how you have to be very specific about who you're going to end up with. And that's one of the reasons why Malcolm's so disillusioned by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, because he's just fucking women by the threes.
I remember that. They said that part of the reason why he was a good match with Betty is because she's the right height.
And the right age.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What is it? Half your age plus seven? I always thought that was like a joke. Half your age plus seven. It is a joke.
We just talked about JFK, RFK, and MLK. There is that moment, and this has definitely been recorded, they portray it in the movie, where he does say the chickens are coming home to roost about JFK getting murdered. Now, you do need the context what he means by that, because it sounds pretty terrible, but even in context, it's pretty harsh. I get what he's saying, though.
I think it was just another example of him actively antagonizing white people and the ruling class. The movie illustrates it, but doesn't really seem to take a stand either way on what we should think about how antagonizing he was. And I can see how, while it's not the right thing to say, it's easy to sit back and judge from the mountaintop of history, especially as white people. But man, Malcolm X's racism was and still is pretty seductive to a black underclass who is probably pretty sick of being told a story of patience and togetherness and progress when the reality of their lives reflected something dramatically different. And it's quite possible that a lot of black Americans heard the words of the Kennedys and just, you know, shook their heads and rolled their eyes and said, yeah, yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. Which you, Ryan, frequently have that attitude when people say hopeful things. You know, yeah, well, that's very naive of you. How adorable that you believe the right thing, the good thing will happen.
Like that a certain president will get impeached.
Yeah, there might have been people who were happy to see white people suffering. Oh, how does it feel when your beloved leader is gunned down?
Yeah.
Because we have to deal with this all the time. So I can see how there's like a certain level of catharsis. It may not be the best human instinct to want to say something like that, but it's still a human instinct.
I think it also is a movie's way of saying, I see my own fate. JFK was stirring up the hornet's nest, and I'm doing the same thing. He was killed, I'm going to be killed. I don't think Malcolm X in reality knew that, although maybe he did predict it. But in movie language, he was predicting his own fate in his own movie.
I wonder if Malcolm X was in a way inviting martyrdom. Only, surely he didn't expect martyrdom to come at the hands of his own people. But he says the line, I always expected death. I was not prepared for betrayal.
We've talked a lot about the black and white conflict, and of course he stirs that up a lot in the film, and I'm sure in reality. One of the more infamous scenes in the whole film, and apparently it happened in real life, is the college student, the young white woman, comes up to him, I think she's blonde, and says, what can a white person do to help your cause? And she's so innocent and so sweet, nothing. And I've heard in reality that he did feel bad about that, and a lot of black people say, well, fuck her! But I think it's going to show, and Spike Lee is putting this scene there for a very important reason, which is the guy was rude to her. He was mean. She wanted to do something good. And he said, fuck you, leave me alone. But then later in the film, he goes on his pilgrimage to Mecca, and he realizes this isn't just about black people. It's about anybody who wants to do the right thing, who wants to look at our faith. I suppose that's part of it. He never was trying to say later on, as I remember, you have to be Muslim to be in my group. But maybe that's the underlying hint. But the point being that anybody who wants to be part of this can be part of this. But when he sees that girl, no, get out of my face. You're white. You don't count.
And Lee makes the point, you know, he doesn't end that scene focusing on Malcolm. He ends that scene focusing on the girl and lets the audience see that hurt look on her face. The moment that she might be disillusioned.
And then she went on to hate black people for the rest of her life.
And if she had just been patient, then he would have come around. You have to wonder if maybe he always remembered people like that who came up to him and offered their help. And, well, he did. He did. He felt bad for turning them away when they would have helped. And, you know, in other movements in black civil rights, there were lots of white allies who were killed as well. There were white people who died in that march on Selma.
And Robert Kennedy was trying to do things differently than his brother had. When MLK was killed, it was only a few months before RFK was killed. He went into some, I think it was Harlem, but he went in somewhere, some region where the cops wouldn't go with him. So he must have had some kind of security, but he went in there to try to speak to these people and tell them, listen, things can change. I'm trying to help make that happen. And then he was gunned down not that long after Martin Luther King was.
Man, the 60s were a crazy time for that.
Great era, but also a terrible one.
What a crazy time to be alive. That must have been the sheer upheaval of everything. And people just must have had no idea how it was all going to turn out and shake down and if things would ever get back to normal. Kind of like now. In a completely different way. I feel like I could relate more than ever to what it must have been like to be alive during these tumultuous times.
So many people were plugged in a way that they're not now. Yeah, they're literally plugged in now, but they really did more than they... Well, a lot of people would say, oh, I'm doing something. Well, not enough people probably are. Anyway, let's get back to something that's positive. The pilgrimage scene, because I wouldn't want to go to Mecca, but I certainly appreciate that Malcolm did. And they shot it in Mecca. It was the first non-documentary to get permission to do that. Spike Lee wasn't allowed to go in because he's not Muslim. Now, when they say go in, I guess they mean right into the holy city. There aren't that many shots. I think they actually shot there. They probably did a lot of the recreated sets deal. When you see Malcolm praying by himself in this big room, that's got to be a set. I don't think they let him go in there and then have all these people traipse around there with their movie stuff for hours at a time.
Yeah, they're really very precious about that.
But there's some helicopter shots at the very least. If nothing else, they got some B-roll footage.
It's incredible because Muslims in Saudi Arabia in particular, they're very particular about when and how they allow photography.
Mm-hmm.
I partially grew up in Saudi Arabia. I spent 4 years of my childhood in Riyadh. You could get arrested for just having a camera. If they just caught you taking a picture of anything, of a building, of anything. There were stories that went around because, you know, people would try to break the rules. But they don't mess around with that stuff. There's no slap in the wrist in that country. You have to genuinely be afraid of the law when you're there and respect the rules. And photography was a huge no-no.
We also see them praying. And, of course, that's 5 times a day for Muslims. And I've always asked the question, I'll say it now in this podcast. Don't they have things to do? Does God require or Allah require you to pray 5 times a day? I guess it does. I guess he does.
Well, it's 5 times a day, and I think that the prayer call amounts to maybe like 20 minutes, so you're talking about an hour and 40 minutes a day.
That's stupid. It's fucking dumb.
Don't say that.
I think it's dumb.
Okay, fine, but
I have no respect for any religion. Let's not forget that.
Okay, it's true. Ryan doesn't care who he offends, but if somebody were to altogether spend like an hour in the gym and that included 20 minutes of commute time back and forth, nobody would consider that a pointless endeavor. And there's lots of studies that show that prayer or meditation can be very beneficial. There's lots of things that are good for you for just taking time out during the day to do something of that nature.
That's a fair point, although 5 times is still a little much.
I mean,
maybe twice.
Islam is an incredibly strict religion. The movie makes no bones about that. They don't allow a lot of things that we would never want to give up. And that includes the ability to sleep in and not wake up before dawn to pray. Again, when I lived in Saudi Arabia, they broadcast on a loudspeaker throughout the city the prayer call. It would wake you up. And it started early, man, at like 5 in the morning was the first one. During the day, if it was happening during the day, all the stores were shut down and people would just lay their mats out on the street facing towards Mecca and pray right where they were. It's a very serious thing that a lot of them do adhere to strictly.
I may have no use for it, but that's pretty impressive.
The devoutness is not like anything that we really see here, or when people do behave at that level of devotion religion here, we consider it unusual and niche, but that's like the entire nation of Saudi Arabia, and they're very strict, and I can see the Nation of Islam clearly was like trying to follow those rules. There has to be something compelling about that. That you can replace one addiction with another addiction, and that addiction might be to rules and structure and authority.
That's a good point, because he is an addict of sorts. He's a coke user, he's a drinker, he's all those things, and then later on he becomes addicted to a faith.
It's like how you hear about how some addicts get addicted to jogging, or they get addicted to yoga, or they get addicted to going to AA meetings. And I say addicted, I mean, obviously it's not as harmful addictions, but there is something to be said for that level of structure protecting you from more destructive bad habits.
So let's talk about the ending where Giancarlo Esposito, among others, riddle the man's corpse with bullets after he's first shot with a giant shotgun. Get your hand in my pocket! Great diversion. The movie portrays, flat out, no dispute of any kind, that it's black people that did it. Who really killed him? Was it the nation? Was it the white establishment? Each benefited by having this guy out of the picture. Did you do any reading about that? I don't know. But the movie portrays that it was black guys who did it, and it seems to be, we don't know for sure, but it seems to be that the Nation of Islam wanted to take him out and get him out of the picture.
When they first started workshopping the film in the 60s, that was in dispute. And even far into the 70s that they were dealing with that in a kind of more ambiguous way. But I didn't see any scandal about the movie very clearly stating that the Nation of Islam was behind the assassination.
I wouldn't put it past white people to bamboozle, hoodwink, I like that bamboozle thing, or even brainwash black people to do this and then have it be blamed on the nation. White people being the CIA, the FBI.
People in power will do some pretty crazy things to stay in power, to protect their status.
So we talked about Denzel, great performance, should have won the Oscar. I've said many times that the two best performances in 92 were Denzel Washington and Jack Lemmon and Glengarry Glen Ross, maybe his best performance ever. And Al Pacino won the Hoo-ah Oscar, but it should have been Denzel for sure. He won years later for Training Day, where he's good, but not the best actor of that year. It was a make-good. But his love interest in the film, not a huge performance, but what a great actress, Angela Bassett, had been in Boys in the Hood the year before this, and What's Love Got to Do With It the year after, where she got nominated for an Oscar and probably should have won. The fight scene she has with Malcolm, somewhere in the middle of the film, was created just to give her something to do, is really what it came down to, because I was reading that they really didn't disagree on these matters. Now, that is what she apparently told the filmmakers and the novelists and everything. So maybe she was just spinning her own relationship to seem better than it was. But the point is that that was a scene, I think, created just so Angela Bassett wasn't entirely a love interest who had nothing else to do on screen but be perfect.
It was also a device to explain where the conflicts came from. This writer, Gabrielle Moss, wrote in Slate, she coined this great term that I love called the reactress, which she uses to describe this trope in films, particularly biopics can be bad for this, where she's the actress who plays the wife or girlfriend, who's mostly there just to provide the emotional reactions that our hero is too brave and too stoic to express himself. She's kind of the de facto Greek chorus. She says all the things that he doesn't want to say, points at all the things that maybe he hasn't quite observed yet. And like most wives in biopics, Betty's presence really does serve as this symbol and reminder of all the things that Malcolm must sacrifice to achieve his goal. She's the happy domestic life that is waiting for him at home when he's traveling. She is the future that he's robbed of when he's assassinated. And her struggles are universally wrapped up in his struggles. She doesn't really seem to have a character of her own outside of this. And it's a criticism, I guess, only in the way that, you know, if there were more biopics about women, there would probably be a perfectly equal husband counterpart to this trope. So I don't use it as a criticism. It's actually like a very useful device to tell the story. That's really what she does. You have a great actress, one of the greatest. We've said before that, you know, if there was any justice, Angela Bassett would be one of the greatest actresses in, or right actors in Hollywood. Yeah. Or right up there with, you know, Robert Redford. There's a reason why she's never been a movie star, and it has a lot more to do with her gender and the color of her skin than her talent, because she's incredible. So it feels like she's a little bit wasted, but they clearly at least tried.
I think it's the color of her skin specifically, because there are a lot of women like Diane Keaton or Meryl Streep who are around the same age, I guess they're a little bit older than her, who've had great careers and who are big stars and who will go down as some of the great actresses. And Angela Bassett might be forgotten by the history of Hollywood because she's floundered in having shitty roles a lot of the time.
She's had some great ones, though, too.
Well, those three in a row I mentioned, but she didn't get enough, I think, because she's got black skin. Al Freeman Jr. plays the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. You hear that phrase so often in this film. He appeared in just 17 movies in 40 years and did mostly TV, but it's a strong performance. I think he played him in some other movie. I was reading that somewhere where he played Muhammad. And then Delroy Lindo is West Indian Archie. He's been a good actor in a lot of things. Love him in Get Shorty a couple years after this. He's the numbers runner when Malcolm is at his, not lowest, I guess, because he seems to like his life back then, but when Malcolm's doing all the wrong things. And then Kate Vernon, Sophia, a lot of more TV shows than movies for her. I didn't really find anything all that relevant for her career. But then there's a lot of great actresses that Spike's used many times. Teresa Randall is Laura, the early girlfriend who becomes a pro. I think she worked with Spike a few times. And Lynette McKee certainly did. She's Malcolm's mother. She did a lot of movies with Spike Lee. But then you got some big-name actors who have very small roles. Karen Allen is in one scene, so the Raiders of the Lost Ark actress. Christopher Plummer plays the preacher that Malcolm goes on about how Jesus is black. That's a great scene. I know you like that one a lot. We talk about Peter Boyle being the cop who says, that's more power than one man should have. He meant to say black man. Giancarlo Esposito, who had been in Do the Right Thing and kind of annoying as bugging out. Great on Better Call Saul. Great in Breaking Bad as Gus Fring. And great in this movie. I'd forgotten he was in it for a while because I knew he was, but then I forgot as the movie's about 3 hours in before you actually see him. And he and those other guys who play the killers are just stone-eyed. They're awesome in that little bit of the movie that they're all in. Ozzie Davis, who was the mayor in Do the Right Thing, gives the eulogy. He actually gave Malcolm X's eulogy, so I guess he just read what he said many years before, about almost 30 years before. And at the very end of the film, of course, Nelson Mandela appears as himself. He isn't actually called Nelson Mandela, but he is. And you got Bobby Seale, the Black Panthers leader, and Al Sharpton appearing as street preachers when they've got the cameras spinning around and they focus back on Malcolm as they should.
Yeah, that seems interesting because the movie ignores some historical context. Like, it's strange that aside from a handful of acknowledgments of the existence of MLK, that street preacher scene is maybe the only reference to the rest of the Black Civil Rights Movement, which was going on at the same time, even though one of the most outspoken and important figures of that movement, James Baldwin, was one of the writers of the script. Of course, he took his name off of it, or I should say his family took his name off of it when it finally got made. This is a really colorful way of describing his experience. He said, I think that I would rather be horsewhipped or incarcerated in the forthright bedlam of Bellevue than repeat the adventure. He spent years working on the script and then ultimately had his name by his family taken off.
So that's a dig at Hollywood, not Spike Lee, I guess, right? Because Spike wasn't on the project until the early 90s.
No, it's actually interesting how Spike got on the project. Originally, it was supposed to be directed by Norm Jewison. Marvin Worth, the producer, had hired Norm Jewison to direct it, and he certainly has had experience with similar types of films. He directed In the Heat of the Night, no stranger to this. He later on directed The Hurricane, but Spike Lee, along with some others, raised a big stink about it.
They bullied him out of it.
They bullied him out of it, and they said, a black person should direct this film. No matter how well-meaning and thoughtful a white person is, they're never going to bring that really essential black experience to the film. And I happen to agree with sentiments like that. Some stories are just better told by people who are part of that culture, the way that Spike Lee is part of Malcolm X's culture. And then they got him put off a film, and then conveniently Spike Lee, I guess, got the job. Mm-hmm. So you might say that it was just a ploy for his own career, and he had said that the book was tremendously important to him. He read it, and when I say the book, I mean the autobiography of Malcolm X, which is considered one of the greatest autobiographies ever written, and it has tremendous reviews. I've never read it myself. He said that was tremendously influential, changed his life. He read it in junior high, and he said that it has always been his dream to film that book. Of course, he had ulterior motives, but was it the wrong thing to do? Was it the wrong choice for Worth to make? I don't think so. I don't think that Norm Jewison, the director that he is, would have made a better film than this.
No, he was a good director, and I said that on other podcasts we've covered, well, In the Heat of the Night at least. I don't think we've covered anything else. Moonstruck, we covered that too. That he was always a good director, but never a great one. He's like the Spencer Tracy of directors. Well, Spencer Tracy's greater in his field than Jewison was. Always really good, but the movies themselves were not necessarily classics. I didn't think so, as good as some of them were. Jewison wasn't bullied out of The Hurricane. I guess he didn't let people do that to him. I don't know if Spike Lee spoke out again, and if he said, no, this time I'm making this movie. I don't care what you think.
And Denzel Washington plays
right, and he was great in that movie. He could have won the Oscar that year, but he still didn't win Best Actor until 2 years after that. And that was 9 years after Malcolm X. Spike Lee obviously directed Do the Right Thing, still his best movie, which we covered a few years ago, nearly the end of the Top Nender project. It was one of the last movies we did cover. He's made 25-ish movies, which is pretty good for a guy who just got started in the mid-80s. The money in this movie, at least, maybe all of them you could say, is on the screen. And there's that great story I've talked about, I think before, probably in Do the Right Thing, where he discusses on Inside the Actor's Studio about how all the black celebrities he asked to help shell out money to finance the film, they came through. Bill Cosby, he may be anathema to people now, but he was the first one that's mentioned, Oprah Winfrey. There's that really funny moment where he says, I called Magic, called Michael Jordan, told him how much Magic gave, and then he starts laughing as if it's a competitive thing, because Michael Jordan's the most competitive people who's ever lived. Tracy Chapman's mentioned, all these people that contributed money to help make the movie, and it wasn't about them getting a financial stake in it, as if they get it back. It was about, help us get this movie made. That was a post-production thing, too. They were going to shut the movie down. He wanted it to be 3 hours, or plus, really. He wanted it to be done his way, and they weren't going to let him, Warner Brothers, that is. But then all these people came through, and good for them to do it, because rich people should come through with causes like that that matter to them. They should come through to help out the black film, or the Jewish film, or the film about a topic they care about, whether it be bullying, or incest, or, I don't know, you name it, abortion. If that matters to them, your rich people contribute and help this. Well, maybe the studio should put up the money, because Spike Lee had been successful in Jungle Fever, and he'd been successful in Do the Right Thing, but they weren't going to contribute more money. So kudos to all those people, including Bill Cosby, for coming through. And that is a great moment. I'll try to find the link on YouTube where he does talk about that with Lipton on Inside the Actor's Studio.
I love the part of the story where he was still negotiating with Warner and wanted more money than they were willing to give him. And he was speaking to Francis Ford Coppola about it. And Coppola advised him to just accept the budget that they were offering and then get the studio pregnant. Which is to say, get a lot of film shot in the can. And then by the time they have passed the point of no return where they would lose more money to give up on the film than to just invest an extra few million, that's when you insist that the only way you can finish the picture is if you get more money. Now, Spike Lee gave up $2 million of his own money into the project as well, but when he asked these celebrities to contribute, it was not an investment. They had no expectation of making a dime off the film. They were just asked to basically donate to the film, because I guess Warner Brothers wasn't going to give up any of their stake in the film. So that really wasn't an option to say, oh, I'll sell you 5% of the film. Warner Brothers was like, no, we own this film. They were so strong in their decision not to give more money that they let it go to the insurance company. There's like a thing that happens where you can just send the film to the insurance company, and the insurance company, without any creative consideration, just does anything that they have to do to get the film finished. And they have the right to fire people. They have the right to make creative decisions, even though they're not creative people. He was really at risk of losing his film, so when he dug his heels in, I mean, you talk about being gutsy and being stubborn. And I'm sure he would have taken his name off the film if things didn't work out for him, but that was a huge risk that he was taking.
Spike and Arnold Pearl had screenplay credit on this one. James Baldwin should have been credited, but he wasn't. I was reading that Spike Lee kind of horned in the credit for writing, that he maybe didn't write the screenplay. He just did what most directors probably do and aided it, but didn't actually flat out write it. But he is on the thing. He's also a producer, as he usually is in his own movies. Marvin Worth, you mentioned him. He was a producer on Lenny. Monty Ross, who did 7 movies with Spike Lee. And there's a lot of other producers, including the big celebrities. I guess in a way, they're all executive producers. And they did based on the autobiography of Malcolm X, which is by Alex Haley and Malcolm X. And this 1972 documentary by Marvin Worth and Arnold Pearl that was nominated for the documentary Oscar but didn't win it in 72. The movie's 185-1. We watched the DVD, which was adequate, I suppose. It wasn't bad anyway. The cinematographer shooting it, we didn't mention his name yet. We should have, because it's Ernest Dickerson, who was Spike's cameraman a lot back then. This was his last movie, though, as a cameraman. He's now directed 9 films and quite a few TV series, including on The Walking Dead. I think he's done several of those episodes. Dickerson and Lee were camera show-offs in this era, and Spike really still is, but together they were show-offs. I generally dig that, though. There are some shots in this movie that are Scorsese-esque, although Scorsese's better than almost anybody else at using the camera the way that Scorsese does, but they have the camera turn upside down. I wouldn't say for no reason, but it is a little bit of a show-off thing. Spike, of course, always has that moment where an actor's on a dolly being pulled towards the camera. That's towards the end of the film, where that woman is, "Don't you pay those fools no never mind, you keep doing what you're doing." It's right before that scene where he's being pulled along on the dolly. Spike Lee is using the things at his disposal to make his movie glitzy.
He uses it prudently, too. It's not overkill. And it always feels thematically appropriate.
Unlike the music, Terrence Blanchard, his longtime composer, who won some awards on 25th Hour, which is a damn good movie that Spike Lee did. We should mention that one. But he never really had any nominations or kudos in other Spike Lee movies. I'm sure Spike liked the music, but I know you didn't like it. It is too much. And sometimes, and this is one of those movies where Blanchard's music, and I guess this is more Spike's fault, is drowning out dialogue.
It's too loud. And it's so bad. It's like taking a beautiful bottle of champagne and putting orange-flavored Kool-Aid in it and calling it a mimosa. It borderline ruins certain scenes, especially the kind of more emotional scenes that he has with Betty or when he's realizing that he's been betrayed. And the strings come in, and it's so blatantly manipulative, but also just bad music. Spike, why do you do that? Why do you love all that melodramatic overkill? He was really guilty of this in Do the Right Thing as well. That's like the one thing I can't forgive him for, is this terrible overuse of score. But of course, I am the person who is very finicky about score, so.
But you are an editor, and Barry Alexander Brown was Spike's editor yet again. He did From School Days all the way up to Old Boy, and I didn't see any credits after that. But that's a lot of movies they made together. For such a long movie, the editing was, you say...
I don't criticize this film for being too long. I think mostly because Denzel Washington is one of the most watchable actors in Hollywood. But when we talk about Spike Lee digging his heels in and insisting that the film had to stay at his over 3-hour length, it did not need to stay that long.
Well, they probably cut a lot of things out, as you would from anyone's life. That's the irony of this, is there probably could have been even more that we didn't see.
I just can see where there was fat to trim. And this isn't to say that any of the scenes that stayed in the movie were bad, because each individual scene was really watchable and entertaining. That makes it hard to make that decision to cut good footage. But there was no reason for this film to actually be over 3 hours long.
And it still succeeded, especially by Spike Lee standards. Okay, the influence is not that much, but I did mention the 1972 documentary, so in a way, this movie's based on that. The line that Malcolm X has at one point in the movie, an important speech, "You're hoodwinked, bamboozled!" And that became a Spike Lee movie in 2000, Bamboozled did. And the biggest thing for influence this movie has, as far as I'm concerned, is that making this movie probably hurt the rest of Spike Lee's career, because he was forever, if he wasn't already, but definitely after this, pigeonholed as the angry black man.
And this makes me mad every time I talk about this so often. He's the angry black man where when Fincher pitches a fit, when Scorsese insists on having things just so, or Kubrick, people respect them more for it. But that's just not a way that a black man is allowed to behave. Even though you have to be a completely stubborn badass to be a black person making movies in Hollywood to begin with, to work through all the pushback that he must have been getting. So I get very frustrated with the label of him as a difficult director, because most directors are difficult. You have to be. It's the nature of the job.
And if he's angry, he deserves to be angry because of the subject matter, especially in a movie like this. And the movie succeeded. That's the irony, too, that he fought for a budget. You think that he would be finally given a chance to have a bigger budget in his future projects. And I don't think he's really ever had that kind of budget that a lot of his contemporaries did get. The movie was nominated for 2 Oscars. Of course, Denzel up against Al Pacino and Ruth Carter's costumes, which was a good nomination. Denzel did not win any major awards. I was looking. Of course, there were a lot fewer awards back in 1992 than there are now. You can get nominated for a dozen, maybe even five dozen awards these days. But he didn't win the Golden Globe. That went to Pacino as well. So obviously, Pacino, it was his year. I always assumed that Denzel was screwed at the Oscars, but you look at it, no, the wave was for Pacino all along. Malcolm X made the National Film Registry in 2010, along with All the President's Men, The Empire Strikes Back, which we covered, The Exorcist, and Saturday Night Fever, which we also covered. So an interesting group of movies, along with, of course, 20 others. It was nominated for the Top 100 Cheers in the AFI list, did not make that, so inspirational. Not really a cheerful film, but inspiring, of course. The Top 100 Genres in the Epic category, that would have been a good choice, but then the 10 epics were probably more epic than this was. The Top 50 Heroes, be tough to put a real-life person on there, I suppose, but it would have been a good choice if they had. And the Top 100 quotes, and I think, as I've said many times, a lot of quotes in that quotes list were stupid. And this is based on a real quote, of course, but we didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us! Which isn't exactly what Malcolm X said, I think, but it's basically the sentiment of it. And it's a great quote delivered so well by Denzel Washington. All right, well, the last thoughts on this long podcast, probably twice as long as last week's podcast, The Awful Truth.
Yeah, speaking of long things, I really hope that the duration and subject matter of Malcolm X doesn't discourage anyone from seeing it. It's not perfect, but it's really good, and it's important, and it's unique, and it's surprisingly watchable.
I've seen it, I think, four times now, and it's one of those movies that really matters as well. Not a lot of great films, quote-unquote, matter.
It's very nuanced, and he comes across as very, very human, and I think that the way that it's grounded and the way that it feels realistic and flawed and honest increases the impact of it so much more than more polished hero worship job could have ever done. It's a really interesting movie. Like, I found it broadened my horizons.
And let's not forget Spike Lee also acts in the movie. We didn't really mention that at all, the whole film, did we? Shorty. But he's not in the movie for all that long. And it really does expose his flaws as an actor. He's very good and Do the Right Thing, I think, actually, for the role he wrote for himself. Not so much maybe in this movie. When you tune us in again in 7 days, we'll be yakking about A French Delight from 2001. Audrey Tautou is the adorable Amelie. So the coming attraction trivia for Amelie. One of my favorite moments in Amelie is when she wonders how many couples in France are having orgasms at that exact moment. How many is it? And Bev knows because we watched the movie only a couple hours ago.
And you will know if you tune in next week to our podcast about Amelie. Check out our website, top100project.com. And don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. While you're there, you can check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered well over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made. Every episode is available for free. If you would like to pay us back for all of this free entertainment, please give us a rating, give us a review. It means a lot to us. It helps people find us.
Or send money to us.
Oh, yeah, you could just put it in an envelope.
Throw it out your window and mail we'll somehow come across us. And we'll find it.
We get paid in love, guys. And we get paid when you reach out to us. We really love to hear from you. And if you'd like to do that, you can find us on Twitter. I am at Bev Ellis Ellis. Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email. Send us a direct message, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to thank our sponsors, Sparkplug Coffee. And don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any size coffee purchase if you use the code top100project at checkout. That's one word, top100project. And it is not case sensitive.
Let's end this thing by any means necessary.
And cut.